From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
I think it'll be easy for these guys. It's not their first rodeo. They're looking forward to it. I think it's more inspiring for these guys than anything else.
So said Miami Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra earlier this week when asked about his team's ability to filter out the distractions. Ahead in Only a Game, the bestest basketball team ever assembled begins its 2010-2011 campaign. Also, a brief history of Sports Illustrated covers, a World Series update, and the chilling tale of the major leaguers who accuse Milwaukee hotel ghosts of attempted force-outs. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Monday, as a ridiculously large number of print, radio, and TV journalists jostled for position beside the court, the Boston Celtics, last year's runner-up in the NBA Finals, ran a short practice in preparation for opening night when Boston would host the prematurely legendary Miami Heat. Shortly after the practice ended, Celtics captain Paul Pierce was asked whether all the hype about the team that had added LeBron James and Chris Bosh to Dwayne Wade during the offseason meant anything to him and his teammates.
I mean, I think it probably means more to you guys and to the fans than us. You know, it's definitely exciting when you get a team of that caliber. You know, nobody has seen that type of talent on one team. I mean, you know, I think it's more, you know, from the media, from the fans. There's more excitement than it is with us.
A day later, mere hours before the Heat would begin what many were convinced would be an 82-0 stroll through the regular season, King James et al. Practiced briefly, and almost certainly unnecessarily, on the very court where they were certainly destined to begin their run to immortality. When they had finished, Chris Bosh was asked how it felt to be employed by a team so preposterously rich in newly acquired talent that Miami could hardly avoid being the powerhouse almost everybody loved to hate.
You know, we don't expect everybody to love what we're doing. We don't expect everybody to support us. As long as we have fans in Miami, a couple fans in every city, that's all we can ask for.
Almost as soon as the actual game began, so did the chants. Overrated, overrated, roared the crowd. Chris Bosh and his teammates must have felt as if their few fans in Boston had stayed home. Perhaps the Celtics were fueled by the enthusiasm of the home crowd. Perhaps it was the challenge of opening the season against the team employing James, Wade, and Bosh, a big three some had predicted would render obsolete Boston's aging grand trio, Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, and Paul Pierce, not to mention Rajon Rondo and recently acquired former LeBron teammate Shaquille O'Neal, who is also pretty big. For whatever reason, the Celtics broke on top, built their lead up to 19 points, and then held off a late Heat charge to subdue the kingdom. Before that game, the Miami Heat had broken the record for preseason hype, generated by a single team consisting of a bunch of stars who had never played together. The game itself broke a Boston credentials request record for a regular season contest. The Celtics slammed the door at 500. At the press conference afterward, Kevin Garnett made it clear that even he and Paul Pierce, veterans both, were impressed by the fuss the occasion had generated.
I just said to Paul as he was coming in here, I said, we're in the finals already, you know. But it did have a lot of hype on it, a lot of good personnel on both teams.
According to Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra, the good personnel on his team had been a lot better.
Well, in practice, it's looked a lot different than this. I mean, it really has, and they've looked terrific playing together. And I think everybody was just a little bit anxious and wanting to make it work so much. But they've had stretches where they're so unselfish. They're underrated off the ball, and there's many different ways they can be effective.
Even in defeat, that was obvious. Late in this game, which appeared at times to be on the verge of becoming a rout, LeBron James almost single-handedly brought the Heat to within 3 points of the Celts. After the game, James seemed to recognize that he, or perhaps one or more of his illustrious partners, might have to do that from time to time.
It almost felt like we were being too unselfish to try to get each other into the game, into the flow of the game. And the reason that we're here and the reason why we've been successful is because we've put ourselves in a position to be aggressive at all times, no matter who's out on the court. So we can't be too unselfish just because we have so many options. We have to still play our game.
LeBron and the rest of Miami's options will be on display throughout the long NBA regular season, and if form holds, well into the playoffs as well. And it would be silly to conclude from Game 1 anything more than what Celtics head coach Doc Rivers wisely noted shortly after his team's first win.
They're going to be a lot better when we see them again, and hopefully we are as well.
For those who haven't memorized the schedule, that will be November 11th in Miami. Here to discuss what might happen henceforth regarding NBA teams, including but not limited to the Heat and the Celtics, is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The Miami Heat have started the season at 2-1. They earned their first win of the season on Wednesday, but not before dashing everybody's hope that they would go 82-0 this season. So was Tuesday's loss to the Celtics any indication of what we can expect from the Heat this year?
I don't think so. I mean, that team obviously is loaded. It's going to be a feeling out process as they learn to play with each other. And when the important games start in April, Mike Miller will be back, and I think that's going to make a big difference for LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. And I don't think anybody has to worry about the Heat missing the playoffs.
The Celtics followed their defeat of the greatest team ever assembled by losing to the team that LeBron James allegedly destroyed by leaving Cleveland. Do the Cavaliers have what it takes to overcome the loss of James and put together a decent season?
Only if they get to play every game against the Celtics on a back-to-back.
That's quite a qualification.
They would win 72 games if they got to play the Celtics on a back-to-back every night, because the Celts are a little long in the tooth. Don't know if you noticed, Bill.
I have noticed that, but they got this young guy, Shaquille O'Neal, looks pretty strong playing for him. Maybe age isn't going to be that big a deal this year.
Well, of the long in the tooth O'Neals, Shaquille definitely looks like the younger, sprightlier one, because the waterlogged corpse of Jermaine O'Neal has played 25 minutes in the first two games for the Celtics, and he put up a 1-for-5, 3 points, 4 turnovers, 7 fouls line. Jermaine O'Neal cannot play in the NBA anymore. So by that measure, Shaq looks great.
Lost in all the LeBronapalooza and predictions that the Celtics and the Orlando Magic are the Eastern Conference teams to beat is the fact that the Chicago Bulls have very quietly assembled a team that some people think could sneak up on those Eastern Conference powerhouses. What do you think?
I love that Bulls team. I think, you know, Derrick Rose, superstar in the making. Carlos Boozer is going to get them some easy points in the paint. Joakim Noah, just a tremendous defender and rebounder. But when it comes down to it, I think they're still a little notch below those other three teams. So probably ultimately another disappointing spring for Bulls fans.
In the West, the Oklahoma City Thunder is expected to do pretty well. Does emerging superstar Kevin Durant have enough of a supporting cast to bring a title to the Big Friendly this season?
The Thunder, they're on their way. Durant is gonna start winning rings eventually. It's just not going to happen this year. Everyone who's counting on or hoping or wishing that the Thunder might prevent the Lakers from another trip to the finals, going to have to wait another year.
Okay, so in your book, the Lakers are going to the finals, but is there any other Western team that might derail them?
Well, it's funny, Bill. I don't know about you, but I'm a year older than I was last year when we had this conversation, and I said the Spurs were too old. I don't know if Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Manu Ginobili are a year older too, but yeah, that team's too old, so no worries there for the Lakers. I'll take Steve Nash at his word that the Suns aren't going to be as good as they were last year, that they're going in the wrong direction with the loss of Amari Stoudemire, and I just don't see anybody out there besides the Thunder that can even push the Lakers deep into a playoff series. The one interesting story that people here in L.A. are looking at. I mean, again, not a contender, but very excited to watch Blake Griffin play for the Clippers.
Any other good storylines that I've missed regarding teams that we really ought to be paying attention to at this point?
Well, one storyline that I was listening to our friends Charles Barkley and Chris Webber talk about is Al Jefferson in Utah, and they're very high on this move, and they think that Al Jefferson could get the Jazz over the hump, being paired with a great point guard in Deron Williams. I don't see it. You know, I just don't see it. I don't think Big Al's a very good defender, and I don't think offensively he gives them anything that Boozer wasn't already giving them. So I feel like the ceiling on the Jazz is exactly where it's always been, first or second round loss. In the Eastern Conference, of course, the wow story of John Wall playing in D.C., well, he opened his career with a 6-for-19 stinker, and I don't see that having any real impact this year. I think he'll be a nice player, but I don't think he can turn that Wobegon franchise around.
Kevin, in off-the-court news, NBA Commissioner David Stern recently fired a couple of typically good-natured salvos across the bow of the SS Players Union. I can understand why he might want to put a hard salary cap on the negotiating table, but is he serious when he says the league is considering shedding a team or three?
Well, I doubt it. No one ever contracts, right? I mean, that's part of the problem. And there isn't really enough talent, as Minnesota Timberwolves fans can attest, to fill out all these rosters. But I don't think that's a realistic expectation. David Stern, he blows my mind. He's got the greatest athletes in the world. And so who does he want to allocate more power to? The referees. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the greatest athletes in the world, and if they turn their palms upward to the sky, we're going to call a technical foul on them.
Well, I think. That's almost like eye rolling.
Sarcastic clapping is a technical. So you now have to, you already can't call a block or a charge, but now you have to be a psychic to figure out if the guy is clapping sarcastically or if the guy is disappointed in you or in himself, because any gesticulation now merits a technical, and I think we saw how ridiculous that can get in the preseason when Kyle Korver tapped himself on the elbow to indicate that he'd been fouled on a shot, and that madman, Kyle Korver, got teed up immediately.
Well, I'm going to take your comments as a demonstration.
Sarcastic clapping.
A demonstration that you don't think that the new rules policy is going to accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah, it'll accomplish watching guys shoot free throws with the lane cleared. I mean, if there's anything less appealing than watching superstars whine all the time, it's watching solitary figures shoot free throws.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com, and he's our Herald of the Hardwood here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If you're a hotshot golfer, then be careful where you sup. You shouldn't pour your Cheerios into the Ryder Cup, for golf's a solemn business for a lot of stuffy twits, and they are bound to bluster if you fill the cup with bits of sugar-coated cereal and feed it to your kids. And Ian Poulter did that, so the poobahs blew their lids. The Stanley Cup's another thing. Who cares if it gets dented or tossed into a swimming pool or lost or maybe rented? But golf is grim, as sure as down is down and up is up. So do not eat your Cheerios out of the Ryder Cup.
I like cereal, you like cereal, no matter who you are. They all like cereal, I like cereal, you like cereal, no matter who you are. You all like cereal, I like cereal, you like cereal, no matter who you are. We all like cereal,
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a story of ghosts and a terrified baseball player trembling in his shorts. But first, the Texas Rangers have never won a World Series. In fact, until now, they'd never even been to one. The San Francisco Giants have been plenty of times, but their last title came 56 years ago when the Giants were still in New York. Joining me now to discuss which team will finally put an end to its World Series woes is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Tim, in 10 postseason games against the Braves and Phillies, the Giants scored a total of 30 runs. Now in two games against the Rangers, they've put up 20 runs. Where did all the offense come from?
That was a question we asked of all the Giants, and typical of baseball, we got no good answer for it. They are the first National League team ever to score 9 runs or more in consecutive games in the World Series, ever. And that comes from a team that most of the season was significantly challenged offensively. But more important, the Rangers have really helped them, especially in Game 2. The Texas pitchers walked 4 batters in a row, 2 of them with the bases loaded. So all sorts of weird stuff has happened already, and we're only 2 games in.
Matt Cain was the Giants' winning pitcher on Thursday night. He's got a losing record in 6 major league seasons, but this postseason has given up a grand total of 1 run in more than 20 innings, and it wasn't an earned run. Did anybody see this coming?
I think some of us did, actually. He's been the best pitcher on their team this year. He's one of the better young pitchers in the game, but he's really been hurt by a lack of run support. So we're never quite sure, you know, where he fits because he never wins enough games to be considered an elite pitcher. But when you look at his career ERA, you look at what a bulldog he is out there, he has been the hardest pitcher to hit with runners on base the last 2 years in the major leagues, meaning when he gets himself in trouble, he usually pitches himself out of it. And I asked Jeremy Affeldt, one of his teammates, what's the deal with this guy when runners get on base? He said he never, ever panics. And that's Matt Cain for you.
All right. I don't know about you, but when the Rangers send former Cy Young Award winner Cliff Lee to face the Giants' 2-time defending Cy Young winner Tim Lincecum, I'm thinking, hey, here comes an 11-7 slugfest. What happened in Game 1?
Again, another beauty of baseball, Bill. I predicted it would be 2-1, at best 3-2, and I even checked the betting line, or someone checked it for me. I don't know how to do that. And the betting line was 5.5 runs, meaning that's the total that were going to be scored in that game, and instead we got 11-7. Cliff Lee, one of the great control artists we've ever seen, missed his location repeatedly in that game. It was stunning to watch, and again, speaks directly to how great baseball is. Just when you think you understand it, you get 11-7 with those two pitchers.
It does lend another dimension to the remaining games. Assuming Cliff Lee gets an opportunity to come back and pitch again, we get to see whether he gets to be the old Cliff Lee or the new Cliff Lee.
Right. It'll be real interesting to see if the Rangers bring him back in Game 4 on short rest, as C.C. Sabathia and others have done in the postseason before. But keep in mind, Cliff Lee has never done that. He is the ultimate creature of habit. His routine is absolutely crucial to him, and I don't see him coming back on short rest in Game 4, no matter what happens in Game 3.
Texas is headed for the comfort of home, or at least the alleged comfort, because the Rangers haven't been all that comfortable in Arlington this postseason. They were 2-3 at their ballpark against the Rays and the Yankees. How will the energy be in Arlington with the home team down 2-0?
The Ranger fans have really connected with this team, and rightfully so. So they'll be screaming and yelling and as loud as you can possibly imagine, and that will really help the Rangers, who need some help at this point. And it brings me back to my days, Bill, when I used to cover the Rangers, 1982 through 85, when they were unspeakably bad. They were well over 100 games, under 500 in the 4 years that I covered them. And I can't tell you how many games we started with about 3,000 people in the stands. The contrast for guys like me will be stunning.
The Giants acquired Jose Guillen from the Royals back in August. The veteran outfielder struggled. He was reportedly suffering from a neck injury, so the Giants left him off their postseason roster. On Thursday night, the New York Times reported that federal authorities are looking into allegations that Guillen received shipments of human growth hormone. Is this a distraction for the Giants at this point?
I don't think so. I had to check on that on Thursday night, and I got some terse no comments from the Giants. I've gathered that there's a lot of truth to this story, but I don't think it's true that they left him off the roster because of this
you know, drug probe. He was an injured player. He wasn't a particularly effective player, and they were going to leave him off anyway. And I was told Thursday night by Giants officials, this is a Major League Baseball matter. It's not our matter anymore.
All right, we can't avoid it any longer. It's time for you to predict the winner of the 2010 World Series. And remember, you can't choose the Yankees.
Yeah, and remember, Bill, I had the Rangers against the Phillies in the World Series at the beginning of the year and the beginning of the playoffs. So the way I look at this, I'm going to be wrong no matter what, so I might as well continue to be wrong. I picked the Rangers in seven games at the beginning of the World Series. But as I like to do, I'm changing my mind. I just think this is the Giants' season. I've seen enough strange things happen now with them, and I don't want to call it luck, but it's almost like fate and destiny's on their side. I think they're going to win this in six games, and they're going to be the World Series champions.
In addition to his regular appearances on Only a Game, Tim Kirkjian is a senior writer for ESPN the magazine and also appears on ESPN's Baseball Tonight. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
There may be no crying in baseball, but there are lots of superstitions. Players don't step on the foul lines when they come off or onto the field. They never talk about a no-hitter in progress. And an increasing number of ballplayers would rather not stay in Milwaukee's historic Pfister Hotel. Milwaukee Public Radio's Mitch Teich explains why teams visiting the Brewers often quake in their spikes.
Carlos Gomez had some tough moments in his first year as the Brewers' center fielder. He missed time with an injured shoulder, and it was only a strong September that allowed his batting average to close in on .250. Still, whatever trouble he had on the field this year pales in comparison to what he experienced off the field in 2008.
A lot of players got different kind of stuff. I don't know if it's true, but what happened to me is 100% sure.
It was a Friday afternoon in June, and Gomez was then playing for the Minnesota Twins. The Twins, like many visiting Major League teams, stayed at the Pfister Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. The game wasn't until that night, and Gomez had just woken up from a nap when he noticed something was a little off about his room. First, he says the lights he had left on were now off, and the lights he had left off had been turned on. But there was more.
And I've stopped putting my clothes, I put on my underwear, and I leave my iPod in the bed. And my iPod started changing the music by itself. I hear kind of noise, like they change the music. And I go touch, and before that I touch, they stop. And when I back out to a step back, they start again. I come back, touch, they start. And I'm taking my shoes and my pants, and I be in no t-shirt. I'm running my room and on the wear. I put on my pants and my shirt in the lobby.
Yes, if you were in the lobby of the Pfister Hotel that day, that was a Major League Baseball player you saw in his underwear before he grabbed a cab and headed for Miller Park. So, okay, in the grand scheme of things, lighting changes and a rogue iPod don't rank up there with the spookiest scenes in The Exorcist or the most chilling scenes in Poltergeist. But the experience shook Carlos Gomez enough that he confided about it to his first base coach, who was sufficiently creeped out that he slept that night with the lights on and the curtains open. And the next time the Twins came back to Milwaukee...
And I can't sleep, you know. And last year, we come here to the four-game series, and I stay all night long in the lobby.
So for Gomez, the best part of his trade to the Brewers may not have been the promise of a starting outfield job, but knowing he no longer had to stay at the Pfister. But there are plenty of unfortunate major leaguers who have not had the good luck to end up in a Brewers uniform and are still subject to the supernatural goings-on at the Pfister. Mickey Bradley and his colleague Dan Gordon have compiled many of their stories in the book Field of Screams, which devotes an entire chapter to the haunted hotel.
You started hearing about the same places over and over, certain fields that they said were haunted and certain hotels. And one of the hotels that we heard about repeatedly was the Pfister in Milwaukee. Lots of guys either had stories there themselves, they said, or knew of other things that had happened to other ballplayers.
And Bradley points out that these are not just bench players looking to get some notoriety any way they can.
All right, Lincecum is one of my favorites.
That's Tim Lincecum, who you might already know from winning two straight Cy Young Awards and who was now pitching in the World Series for the San Francisco Giants.
At about 4 in the morning, he said he heard a knocking on his door, a pressing on his door, and he just refused to open the door. He flipped the latch on it, and he sort of retreated to the bed and turned on the lights to sleep with the lights on for the rest of the night because he wasn't going to go near that door.
In fact, several players in this year's World Series say they've had ghostly encounters at the Pfister. Colby Lewis, tonight's expected starter for the Rangers, reportedly saw an apparition in his room when he visited this summer. And Texas catcher Matt Traynor was with the Florida Marlins when he and a teammate heard knocking on the wall. Writer Mickey Bradley describes what came next.
A few moments later, they heard the screaming of a child. And this is something that people report in the Pfister on a regular basis. They hear a young child, Traynor said he thought about 6 or 7 years old, screaming in the hallway. They opened the door. There's nobody there.
Unlike his cowering colleagues, though, Traynor sought out the ghost his next time through Milwaukee, leading his friends on a late night and unfruitful ghost hunt through the Pfister's hallways. All right, so what is going on at the Pfister? The Rangers' C.J. Wilson set the scene to ESPN Radio in Dallas shortly after he had his own frightening night there.
It's creepy, straight up. It's like something out of, you know, like Eastern Europe or whatever, stylistically.
15-game winner and architectural historian C.J. Wilson aside, the Pfister is maybe described better as old world. The building itself was built before the turn of the century, the last century, in the Romanesque Revival style. Victorian artwork hangs from the walls of an ornate grand lobby, and a real live piano player accompanies the less-than-spooky business lunches going on at the restaurant. Joe Kurth is the hotel's general manager.
I have heard so many stories about the spirit of hospitality within the Pfister.
That is partly marketing speak, but it's also history.
The iconic feeling of the lobby, the grand staircases you walk in, there have been suggestions that Charles Pfister, that grand iconic gentleman at the turn of the century, occasionally stops by to check on the well-being of his guests.
Kurth has been at the hotel for 3 years and says he has not experienced ghosts, either of a benevolent or a mischievous nature, but he's heard the stories ballplayers have told. And so has Allison Jornlin, who runs the website MilwaukeeGhosts.com. And she's not convinced that Charlie Pfister is the ghost playing with lights and iPods of ballplayers.
Certainly, they're not experiencing that same kind-hearted ghost that is seen overseeing the hospitality of his hotel. It seems like they're actually getting more of a prankster entity that is giving them a hard time.
Jornlin says all the stories from ballplayers make a pretty persuasive case for, well, something. But she's calling for players like C.J. Wilson, Adrian Beltre, and Tim Lincecum to go one step further for the cause of science.
It's really important, if something is really going on here, that the team members who've had experiences understand, you know, how important their experiences are to people who are serious investigators in the paranormal field.
She says investigators would ask fact-based questions like exact times and locations, and more philosophical ones, like whether baseball players are being targeted specifically. If that's the case, someone with a higher authority would have to order such an investigation. And as we stand in front of the Pfister Hotel, the full moon rises over the office of the baseball commissioner, right across the street. A call to Bud Selig's office went unreturned. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Milwaukee.
The Brewers are dead this season. That's a little pre-Halloween joke for you. But the Pfister lives on. To check out Mitch Tyke's photo gallery, please visit onlyagame.org.
I just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bell started ringing and chains rattled out. I knew I'd done moved in a haunted house. Till I made up my mind to stay. Nothing was gonna drive me away. But I seen something that'd give me the creeps. It had one big eye and a two big feet. I stood right still and I did the freeze. He did that old stroll right up to me.
You're listening to Only a Game. Among the former Giants participating in the first pitch ceremony before the first game of the World Series on Wednesday night were Monty Irvin, Willie McCovey, Orlando Cepeda, Juan Marichal, and Gaylord Perry. I grew up a Giants fan. I know those names. Cases can be made for honoring each of them, cases that reflect the myriad charms of baseball and recall the various sorts of stories, happy and not, that accrue to any team that's been around as long as the Giants have. Monty Irvin played 10 years for Newark in the Negro Leagues before becoming the first black member of the Giants in July of 1949. He's the only one of the honorees old enough to have been robbed of part of his major league career by baseball's color line. In 1954, Irvin was a critical part of the most recent Giants team to have won the World Series. Willie McCovey, who played for the Giants for 19 years, was robbed too. He lost the hit that would have won the 1962 World Series when Satan, cackling, temporarily possessed Yankees second baseman Bobby Richardson and snatched McCovey's line drive out of the air, and I will hear no other interpretation of that hideous event which broke the heart of a 14-year-old boy named me. Orlando Cepeda, unencumbered by the New York connection, was embraced unconditionally by San Francisco fans. He hit a ton and played with glorious enthusiasm. After he retired, he was mixed up in an ambitious, albeit clumsy, transaction involving 165 pounds of marijuana, but that was in another decade, and besides, the smoke has cleared, so Orlando Cepeda is in the Hall of Fame, which is as it should be. One of the two pitchers among the old men on the mound on Wednesday was Gaylord Perry, who has cheerfully acknowledged throwing baseballs carrying all manner of contraband, though not marijuana, perhaps because the stems and seeds would have slipped off the ball on the way to the plate and left a trail, thus tipping off the umpires as well as the feds. The other pitcher was Juan Marichal, nicknamed the Dominican Dandy because he was. Marichal distinguished himself by winning 243 games over 16 years and by hitting former Dodgers catcher John Roseborough in the side of the head with a bat after Roseborough had nicked Marichal's ear with a ball that he said he was just trying to return to Sandy Koufax. During the brawl that ensued, Willie Mays rushed from the Giants' dugout, cradled Roseborough's bleeding head on his chest and cried, "Johnny, Johnny, I'm so sorry," or so the story has it. Mays was scheduled to join his fellow Giants for that first pitch on Wednesday night, but he was ill, as a sad result of which the otherwise bright occasion lacked the greatest of them all.
Nobody loves this game as much as me, Willie Mays. Yeah, nobody loves this game as much as me, and Willie Mays.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School offers online and on-campus courses to students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Why do you love me? Why do you love me? Why do you love me?
Do you love me? Now that I can dance.
It is a distinction they'll treasure forever. Or maybe not. Last weekend in Hamburg, four German high school students won the Ugly Dance World Cup by dancing less prettily than nine teams from Germany, Luxembourg, and Switzerland. The winning team's signature move was something they called the Shy Dance, and the judges acclaimed it for, quote, epic ugliness and horrible appearance. According to the organizers of the competition, who maintained that it is easy to dance nicely, but ugly dancing is an art, the four winners excelled in unseen moves. Which means what? That the dance got so ugly the judges covered their eyes? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a half century of Sports Illustrated's cover choices. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Today, the San Francisco Giants and Texas Rangers will play Game 3 of the World Series. The Giants are up 2-0. Are the Rangers just spotting the Giants a couple to keep it interesting?
Well, they better win the first one back at the house that W built, or they're in deep trouble. Right now, the Rangers look like they are completely unprepared for playing in the World Series.
Whether their team wins or loses, one particular segment of San Francisco fans is going to be especially interested in how many home runs their team can hit during the series, don't you think?
Yes, the Relief, L-E-A-F, you see what they did there.
That's clever.
The Relief Herbal Center in San Francisco is offering all Giants fans one free marijuana joint for every home run team hits in the World Series. Aren't they glad Willie Mays doesn't still play?
This is for medicinal purposes only, I'm quite sure. Regarding Texas catcher Benji Molina said this week, it's going to be a very happy World Series for Benji Molina.
How can Benji Molina be sure?
Well, he's speaking for two people right now. Benji Molina of the San Francisco Giants and the current Benji Molina of the Texas Rangers. Because he's guaranteed a ring no matter what he does because he was traded from San Francisco to Texas this season.
As reported earlier in the program, the Miami Heat will not be undefeated this season. They lost their first game opening night. Should this have come as a surprise to the proprietors of Hollywood, Florida's Whiskey Tango All-American Bar and Grill?
Well, it's a $4,100 lesson because they vowed to cover the bar tabs of any customer who signed up for what they called the Three King Challenge. They're not serving myrrh, by the way, by means they were going to pay anyone's bar tab up to $25 if the Heat lost. So the Heat lost and all the customers won.
WLRN in Miami is a really cool radio station because they have the good sense to carry only a game and because they recently ran a LeBron James poetry contest. More than 1,000 people submitted entries. Would you like to favor us with the winner?
First of all, I think this woman has a very cool poet's name. Her name is Crystal Booker, which is a very good poet's name. Anyway, her winning entry is, "Letting go is hard, we know. The king is here and we've warmed up his seat. Cleveland, go ahead and spit flames. You can't burn up the Heat." Now, that reads like the translation from the original Slovenian, but apparently that was the winner. But my favorite was the one who came from a guy who used to sell food at the Heat games. "Arepa! Hot dog! Soda! Shish kebab! Feeding hungry Heat fans is my job. The summer's over and they'll be back, but this year I'll be a little bit more busy. I traded in my apron for a LeBron jersey." Busy in Jersey.
Busy.
See what he did
Jersey.
There?
Now
see what he did there?
That's just, okay. Yes. Okay, moving right along. Former NBA star Allen Iverson has signed a 2-year, $4 million deal with a Turkish pro team. So what's Turkish for practice?
Is he delighted? Ha, ha, ha. Oh, that's very bad.
Boy.
That was really bad. That was almost as bad as that LeBron poem right there. Yeah, he's going to make $4 million over 2 years with a team called Besiktas. And I hope they don't practice very often because we know he doesn't take to it very well.
If Brett Favre takes the first snap for the Vikings when they play the Patriots tomorrow afternoon, and then he hobbles over to the sideline and calls for a substitute because he has decided that his broken ankle does hurt after all, his string of consecutive starts will be 292. What's the likelihood that it works out that way?
Probably pretty good, although Brad Childress could become my favorite person in the history of professional football if he just doesn't start him at all, thereby sending Fox and later that night NBC into having to crate up all those adjectives again.
Charlie, large numbers of college football teams will be facing off against each other today. Which particular matchups should we be paying attention to?
Well, it's a big weekend in the SEC, actually. Florida and Georgia play in the annual I Wear My Mullet with My Pickup Truck Bowl, also known as the world's largest cocktail party.
Oh,
and Auburn goes to Ole Miss, and this will be Ole Miss's equivalent of a bowl game. It's possible at that point that Auburn will lose, thereby clarifying the bowl picture and causing all the Boise State people to run up the glacier in celebration.
Researchers at Ithaca College released a report that squashes at least somewhat the notion that scholarship athletes really do get a free ride. What did they find?
Well, they found that Division I athletes usually have to pony up somewhere close to $3,000 a year in school-related expenses that aren't covered in the grants and aid. Now, we hear this all the time. Well, they're compensated through their scholarships. Well, no, they're not, actually. And on top of that, they have 60-hour-a-week jobs that requires travel all over the United States of America. Hopefully, this study will get circulated to those people who don't know any better.
All right, Charlie, here's a little quiz to determine how much attention you are paying to a pro golf landscape not being dominated by Tiger Woods. Depending on how things go this weekend, one of two golfers could replace Mr. Woods as the top-ranked player in the world. Who are they?
Ben Hogan.
I like it.
No,
and Sam
no,
Snead.
No, and Bobby Jones.
There you go.
No, actually, as I pick up this piece of research material that was handed to me by the Only a Game sports staff.
Wait a minute.
Apparently,
people aren't supposed to know that.
It would be Lee Westwood, who I have actually heard about, and Martin Kamer, who I have not.
There you
so
go.
I'm rooting for the guy I haven't heard of.
On December 2nd, FIFA will announce whether Belgium and the Netherlands, England, Portugal and Spain, or Russia will host the 2018 World Cup. The bidding process has been characterized by some as corrupt.
No!
Only by those who've been paying attention to it. So that means Russia gets it, right?
Well, I don't know. The Russians and the English are feuding with each other. My favorite one comes from the bid leader of the Russian effort, Alexei Sorokin, who criticized England's bid to host the 2018 World Cup by saying that London has, quote, a high crime rate and a youth drinking problem. This is a Russian saying this. How much of this nonsense am I supposed to swallow? Please give it to Belgium and the Dutch.
During this year's World Cup, Paul the Octopus successfully predicted the result of every game the German team played, and this week, I guess, Paul recognized that his work was done.
That's what they'd like you to believe. The international soccer gaming cartel got in there and killed him because he was too good. He was messing up their game. So, yes, we will have to find another soccer-picking octopus. Luckily, the Russians probably have several on retainer on hand.
Yeah. For the record, I think we should clarify that Paul the Octopus lived pretty much exactly as long as octopi generally live, whether or not they're picking winners in the World Cup.
That's right. I mean, he lived as long as most octopi who are interested in soccer live, which is 2.5 years.
Until quite recently, Sister Virginia Muller of the School Sisters of Notre Dame in Baltimore had never heard of Honus Wagner, one of the 5 original inductees into baseball's Hall of Fame, but Sister Virginia knows who the Flying Dutchman is now. Explain, please.
Yeah, one of the 100-year-old baseball cards, one of the most, the most sought-after baseball card among collectors, was donated to the order, and they're auctioning off, which the card is not in very good condition, apparently. It's going to get somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000, all of which will go to their mission ministries around the world. I am really sorry that this wasn't something she confiscated from some kid in fourth grade 60 years ago.
Don't
I think
be playing
that would,
with those
I think
cards.
That would be very cool.
And finally, Charlie, it is not unusual for pro athletes to try to establish themselves as recording artists. Shaquille O'Neal has done that, as have Ron Artest, Bernie Williams, and the 85 Chicago Bears. Do you suppose that that's what encouraged Alexander Ovechkin of the Washington Capitals to attempt the crossover?
Well, there's gangster rap, and then there's Russian gangster rap. You know what the difference is? Tattoos on the knuckles, my friend. He's going to do a record with Eminem. He's going to do a rap record with Eminem, of whom he is apparently a terrific fan, and points out that Eminem's 8 Mile film is just great. Thank you, Alex. Very nice. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Thank you for plugging that, and I'm looking forward to not hearing this.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, and he joins me each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
They have featured athletes, of course, athletes as champions, athletes as victims, athletes as role models, and athletes as felons. They've featured individuals and teams who would perhaps just as soon not have been featured, especially if they're superstitious. And each February, they have featured smaller and smaller swimsuits. Of course, I'm speaking about the covers of Sports Illustrated, which are now all available in a single book titled, remarkably, Sports Illustrated, The Covers. Joining me now to discuss same is Terry McDonald, the editor of the Sports Illustrated Group. Terry, welcome to Only a Game.
I'm glad to be here. I like the show.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The magazine began in 1954. Is there a historical story about how the first cover was chosen?
Well, the most interesting story from my point of view is the cover that never ran. It was the dummy of the very first cover of the very first issue, and what it showed was fans at a college football game. There was no football action. It was just the fans. And what Henry Luce was suggesting there, and when he took it around to advertisers, he explained this, that this was a magazine that was really for fans, this new leisure class that was going to enjoy watching sports. And so he put them on the dummy to explain what he was doing, and then the first cover had Eddie Matthews on it.
So the idea of featuring the fans went begging right from the beginning.
Well, not really. The point was that it was always from the fans' point of view, and that the magazine would be an advocate for the fan and would be the conscience of sports in that regard.
Denny McLain appears on the February 23rd, 1970 cover, and the headline reads, "Baseball's Big Scandal." Did Sports Illustrated include investigative reporting from the outset, or was that a later development?
I think it came in the 60s, and I think it was mostly a reflection of the change in the sports culture. When media got big and show business became a part of sports in a very big way, there was a lot more money. And at that point, I think Sports Illustrated became very, very interested in what was going on beneath the surface of the games.
It's interesting that you mentioned the connection between sports and show business because, of course, they have become more and more indistinguishable over the years. Do you suppose SI was paying homage to that trend when Gary Cooper made the cover in 1959 and then on August 23rd, 1971, when they put actor Steve McQueen on the cover?
Well, Gary Cooper was a famously great sportsman. He was a hunter, and he fished around the world, and he was a skier. He was a graceful man who could do a lot of things. And that image of the American man as athlete, I think, sort of fit right into the idea at the time about, you know, what sports was all about. It was about leisure time, too, back mm-hmm. then. And Steve McQueen, I don't know, that might just have been about the movie.
Do you know when it first occurred to somebody, either at Sports Illustrated or elsewhere, to begin talking about an alleged Sports Illustrated cover jinx?
Yes, I do. It was in 1957 when Oklahoma, under Bud Wilkinson, was enjoying a winning streak of, I believe, 47 games. And on the cover of Sports Illustrated, the headline read, "Why Oklahoma Cannot Be Beat." And, of course, 6-0, you know, 2 days later at Notre Dame. And people started to pay attention to it, and then it became fun. And it's still a lot of fun. If you think about it, though, it really is something that statisticians refer to as regression to the mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, water levels out. We usually find that we are putting people on the cover right when they're peaking, or if we're doing our jobs, we are, and that's when they are, of course, ripest to tumble.
There's an admission in the book that the people who've chosen the covers over the years have made some dumb mistakes, especially in terms of omissions. How is it, for example, that Annika Sörenstam, the most accomplished female golfer of all time, has never once made the cover?
I don't know. And that I take personally because I decide what's on the cover, and that's been on my watch. I think, you know, you have to think about what was going on at the time and when they had a big win and what else there was. It's regrettable, though, in her case, because she is a dominant, wonderful athlete and, you know, great person.
Women have made the cover as swimsuit models, of course, and sometimes as victims of attacks, such as when Monica Seles was featured after she was stabbed back in 1993. Billie Jean King got half a cover on December 25th, 1972. But is it fair to say that SI has paid insufficient attention to female athletes as far as the cover has gone?
I think so. We think about that. We talk about it. And you know, you follow the news, and you can hide behind that to a degree. But I think, sure, there could be more women on the covers.
Among all the covers that you've been present to see go to print, have you a favorite?
I have a lot of favorite covers. I love the way a cover we did of Tom Brady, just the way it looks. It's so heroic. He looks so good. It's the sort of the best of football and.
It was back when he cut his hair in a decent way, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I think he looks pretty good. but he looked good then, too. I was very proud when we broke the story about Alex Rodriguez and his use of performance-enhancing drugs. It was a sad cover, but I was very proud of the way the magazine had gone forward and reported the story. And when everyone was telling us that we were wrong and that we were, in fact, lying, we were right. And there was a great satisfaction in running that cover.
Does the cover of Sports Illustrated seem as iconic, as important now as it has been in the past, given how many people get their sports news now from so many, many different electronic sources?
You know, I don't know, but every time I begin thinking that, something happens. Either we do a cover that is somehow on every television station around the world, or I run into somebody in a small town who tells me that they have it, you know, on their wall, and they have all of the covers, and they keep them, and on and on. And these are not, you know, people who have been subscribers since 1954. These are like 9-year-old kids in Omaha, Nebraska, like yesterday, last week. Athletes like to be on the cover, I'll tell you that.
Well, except the ones who are superstitious.
They like it, too.
Terry McDonald is the editor with the Sports Illustrated Group. He joined me from NPR in New York. Terry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's great to be here.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Sports Illustrated editor Terry McDonald, who describes why the cover photo on June 3, 1963, features Bob Hope in a Cleveland Indians uniform.
Well, he bought the team, and he used it often in his act.
Yeah, well, and then the photo was also a promotional still from that old Bob Hope movie, On the Road to Mudville. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.